for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. When Ashraf Ghani was inaugurated president of Afghanistan last September, he publicly acknowledged his wife, Rula Ghani, the new first lady. It was a hugely symbolic moment in a country where first ladies have kept a low profile and remain mostly behind closed doors. Rula Ghani has chosen not to follow in this tradition. She's running an office in the presidential palace. She's working to shape the troubled country's future. Rula Ghani joins me, and you can see as well as hear our conversation. We'll be video streaming. You can go to drshow.org and click on Watch Live. You can join the conversation by calling us at 800-433-8850. You can go to drshow@wamu.org if you'd like to send an email or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. How wonderful to meet you, Mrs. Ghani.
Thank you so much, Diane. I'm glad to be here.
I'm thrilled to have you here. You know, so much has been made of that moment of your husband's inauguration when he introduced you. Were you surprised or did you expect it?
He had said he would mention me. I thought he'd mention my name. But what he did, he really expressed his appreciation for whatever social work I had been doing with vulnerable people, especially with children that work on the streets of Kabul. So, yes, it was very heartwarming. Mm. He almost choked saying it.
Really?
So the whole audience really felt it.
Now, the whole audience felt it and acknowledged you. How do you think the population at large reacted?
From all the women that have come to see me since, I know it gave them a lot of heart. They felt like finally they had somebody somebody to whom they could talk, who could listen to them, who could understand their concerns, and maybe help them in their difficulties.
And what about the men?
You mentioned in your introduction that I decided to be active, but I didn't decide not to be low-key. I'm still very low-key. I am in my little office on the palace ground. Palace grounds are enormous. and I don't make much waves. What I do is that I receive people and they come to me and they talk. And I don't have a budget. I have a few colleagues. We're now almost eight. I say almost because we were seven when I left. I know that we have one more person that had joined the team. but it's a team that's in progress. And what we're doing is nothing very flashy. We just try to help people and try to understand what their concerns are. I like to think of me as a listener and a facilitator. That's what I am.
Can you give us an example of the kinds of concerns that someone might come to you with?
Usually I receive groups. I don't deal with personal problems, you know, because then it really edges on politics, and I don't want to be into politics. And maybe this is why men don't really mind me too much, because they have their own venues, and I keep my own little venue. Women will come and they will talk. They will talk about the difficulties they encounter. For example, if it's school teachers, they might talk to me about how the system is overloaded, that the schools are crowded, that the process of failing a student is almost uh, inadmissible today, because if ever they try to fail somebody, they will receive phone calls from left and right and will have to reinstate the child. The process of, they do have complaints about what posts they get and how they have to... there is an exam that allows, that kind of supposedly distributes the jobs between the teachers. And it's not everyone that passes the exam. They have to pay their way through it. Let's put it that way. And so they complain. They tell me these things. They told me about, for example, one thing that I might have been able to help them. I don't know yet whether it will bear results. But they told me that the books were full of mistakes. And they knew what the reason was, is that it was not printed in Afghanistan. So it was printed in countries that were familiar with the script but did not know the language. So they couldn't read and proofread what was written in the books. So I have brought this up with some agencies, international aid agencies, that actually fund the printing of the books. And I was saying, please make sure, although the contractors might be Afghan, please have a clause that says that the printing has to be done in Afghanistan so that somebody can proofread. A chemistry teacher told me, you know, you have a problem that starts on one page, and it's only 4 pages later that you have the follow-up, the other part of the problem. So it's really quite... So that gives you an example. It's not earth-shaking. I am not changing lives. But I am trying to figure out where the problems are and how we can solve them.
Rukla Ghani, she is the First Lady of Afghanistan. Her husband, Ashraf Ghani, was inaugurated President of Afghanistan last September. You are welcome to join the conversation. 800-433-8850. Mrs. Ghani, tell us what in your background led you to take a more public role as First Lady.
Well, I think my age, that means that my children are now in their 30s. They are not in need of my presence every day. They're not babies that I need to, clean up every second time that they eat or whatever. But they are not my preoccupation anymore. The first month I was at the palace, I just sat, and I did nothing. I watched TV, I read books. I got bored. So I decided to do something. Now, why did I choose what I'm doing right now? It is something that I've always done. I always like to understand the environment in which I'm living, whether it was when I lived here or where I lived in other places.
Here in the States.
Yes, or whether now I'm in Afghanistan. And I had engaged in the social work in Afghanistan before that. So given my situation, which means I'm the First Lady, which means that I can't really move around very easily, I'm staying within the palace four walls, I figured out that the best way would be to have an open door policy. So it's very easy. People call, they talk to my secretary, we have a certain kind of filtering that we do. I don't see individuals. I see groups. I usually like to know what they want to discuss
before they come in.
Yes. So in case they want to discuss something that's political, they can already know that I'm not going to take part in that part of the discussion. But if they want to tell me about their conditions of life, their problems, I had once a delegation of young people from Ghor, which is a province in the central Afghanistan, quite inaccessible because it's in the mountains. And they wanted to discuss politics. And I said, you know, they have worked for one candidate during the election. And now I said, you know, I'm the first lady of all of Afghanistan. You're all my children. So I'm ready to listen to you, but please let's put the political discussion aside. So we started talking about the fact that that the road that links them to the city of Herat should be paved, because it would make it much easier for them to reach there, although it's still like 5 or 6 hours drive. And then after that, I said, okay, I'll pass it along, but I'm not promising anything. So this is basically what I do.
Ruth Haghani, the First Lady of Afghanistan. When we come back, we'll talk about her childhood, many other things. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Rhodes Scholar, with educational travel adventures to 150 countries, including Cuba, offering experiences for grandparents and grandchildren, active outdoor enthusiasts, and others. A catalog is available at roadscholar.org. From Cigna, a global health service company dedicated to helping people improve their health, well-being, and sense of security, at cigna.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
And if you're just joining us, Ruth Haghani, who is the First Lady of Afghanistan, is here in the studio. You can watch live video of our program by going to drshow.org. And if you have questions, you can call us on 800-433-8850. Or send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Mrs. Ghani, you are a Lebanese Christian. You were born in Lebanon. Tell me about your background and your education. I'm really interested in that childhood in Lebanon.
Lebanon at the time was the most beautiful country in the world.
That's what my mother used to tell me.
She was Lebanese.
Yes.
Yes, it was a wonderful place to grow up. We grew up trilingual. We grew up knowing everything about the West, but at the same time keeping very strong cultural root in the East. Stories that my grandmother would tell me about her childhood. When I reached Afghanistan, it was exactly what she had described. I had very little cultural shock when I came to Kabul in 1975.
And why did you go to Kabul?
Because I had gotten married to my husband.
I see.
We had met at the University of American University of Beirut.
In Beirut.
In Beirut, yes. And I had previously I had gone to school in Paris, France. I had done the Sciences Po, Institut d'études politiques. But when I came back to Beirut, I found out that I knew a lot about Europe, but I didn't know anything about my country or about the region. So I enrolled with AUB, and I also started working as a journalist. And I learned like this a lot of things. And this is where, from that phase, that I definitely developed the sense of trying to understand what is around me and to gather information. So, I was fortunate to go to AUB because I met my husband there, and then we married and went to Afghanistan.
But when did you come to the States?
A few years later, my husband had at the time only an MA, and he got a scholarship to do a PhD at Columbia University. So we came to New York City, and unfortunately, a year later, the civil war started in Afghanistan, and part of his family was put in jail. He actually lost an uncle who died under torture, we decided we'll stay, we'll wait. And he got his PhD, and then by that time we said, well, we have to find a job here. And he got a professorship. He first started at Berkeley as a visiting lecturer for a semester. And then he got a position at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, where he taught anthropology, which was his specialty at the time.
And, of course, then you lived in Baltimore for how long?
For 10 years.
And don't you have triple citizenship?
Yes, because staying in the States, we needed to apply for a green card, which at the time was given rather quickly because with all his family, all the male member of his family in prison, he did have a basis for political asylum. So we did get the green card, and then five years later, we got the citizenship. And both our children were born here, so they are Americans too.
So your Lebanese Christian heritage puts you in a country that is 99% Muslim. Where do you feel most at home?
I feel at home wherever I am.
Uh-huh.
I think you learn to blossom wherever you've been planted. I think it's something you need to learn in modern days because people keep moving, even within the United States. People move from one town to the other, from one city to the other. And they learn. They learn that there is a period of transition, and then you learn to adapt to your new environment. And you make friends, and you find occupations, and then you become part of that place. But in your question, you seem to think that because I'm born in a Christian family, it should be such a big contrast with what was Afghanistan. I'm an Eastern Christian. I'm a Maronite, which means we pray in Arabic, which means we pray in the same language all Muslims pray. And the religious vocabulary is the same. I often use expressions that are supposed to be for non-initiated people, just Muslim expressions, but are religious expressions. And for me, it's no problem using them because I believe in what I'm saying.
Mm.
And as I said, the culture was pretty much the same between Lebanon and Afghanistan. So for me, I feel maybe much more at home in Afghanistan than I ever was here in the States because in the States I still was this very kind, very nice woman that comes from Lebanon. My children have had less difficulty than I have had because they were born here and they grew through the system, the educational system, and made it to college and then have worked. But I always felt somehow that, you know, I was not exactly fitting completely in the States.
Your mother came from Alexandria, Egypt,
yes.
Whereas your father was from Lebanon. Mm-hmm. How did they meet?
Well, my mother was from a Lebanese family living in Egypt. Her grandfather had gone to Egypt. At the time, it was the Wild West of Lebanon. You went to Egypt to make a fortune. And indeed he did. But they used to come back every summer to Lebanon. And this is where she met my husband. She met her husband.
And what did
my father.
What did your parents think about your marriage to Ashraf Ghani?
I think at the beginning they were a little bit reluctant. I was going to a faraway country, a country that they didn't really know. My father accompanied me to Afghanistan before I got engaged. He wanted to meet the family, so he met the family, and he really liked the family, but still he was not sure whether it was exactly what I wanted. But my father was a very open-minded person, and he told me, well, you are determined to marry this young man. I can see he's a very, very bright young man, and I can understand why. If you find that it gets difficult, you can always come back home.
The door is always open.
That was 40 years ago, and I'm still with my husband.
Of course. Your husband has a goal of eliminating internally displaced people within 5 years. You are also working in that regard. Who are these people who are internally displaced?
Well, the name itself says it. They've had to leave where they lived. And usually they come from provinces. Maybe there have been fighting there. And so they leave. Maybe some warlord decided to take over all their land. So they have to leave. Or maybe there is some economic factor where they want to come to the city. They congregate in the suburbs of the city, and unfortunately, they were a very small number. Their number is increasing, maybe because there are refugees now that had gone to other countries that are now returning to Afghanistan, and some of them have no place to go to, so they go to these camps. It's the worst kind of situation. They don't really have dwellings. Usually, the local authorities don't want them to become permanent, so they don't allow them to build. Some places they do, but in some places they don't. And so you have maybe a tent that would be maybe half this room, which would be like 4x3, maybe two rows of stone on the ground, and then on top of it a few pieces of cloth, not even tarp. And they live inside, a whole family of 12, 13 people. And when it rains, it gets muddy inside. And you know, you've heard about instances where mothers would be going to sleep at night with a baby in their arms. And then if ever the night is very cold, the ground around them freezes and they freeze to death. That's really what happens. So it's really a horrible situation, and it's inconceivable that we should accept it. We should really have a change. Up till now, there has been a lot of humanitarian assistance sent to distributed in these camps. But I do have a problem with humanitarian assistance because it doesn't seem to resolve their problem. They're still there. Their numbers are increasing. There are about 700,000 IDPs registered in Afghanistan.
So what do you believe needs to happen, and what can you do to help make it happen?
I was very naive, and I didn't know. I mean, I wanted to help. I didn't know what to do. And then maybe 6 or 7 years ago, a friend here, an American friend, told me, oh, I'm going to have $20,000, but I would like to spend it on, I would like to spend it in Afghanistan, but I would like to spend it somewhere where it counts. And I told him, let's see, maybe we can spend it in one of these camps. And so I looked at that camp. There were 900 families. So you see already it's a large camp. And it seemed to me they came from an area that now seemed to be more quiet. And I said, well, maybe we can help them with transportation to go back from where they came. Mm. So I sent a friend who had an NGO to go and take a look and ask questions and figure out. And he came back and he said, it's impossible. I said, why? He said, they cannot go back. They left there because their land was taken. And as long as that person is still there with their land, they cannot go back there. So there I realize it's not humanitarian assistance that's needed. You need political will. You need political will to either decide these people should have a piece of land and give them that piece of land and build on it to dwellings, a township, with all the things that are needed, shops, mosques, schools, clinics, even attract industries to provide for employment. You know, a place that could be maybe far from town but would be self-sufficient so that they would be comfortable living there and make a living, make a life there. Or otherwise, it was not going to happen. So my husband does have the political will, and I hope that once he starts doing what he's supposed to do, I'll be able to help.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. But it seems to me, as you speak, Mrs. Ghani, you have moved into somewhat the political realm by offering to your husband your understanding of what's happening there and engaging him in that effort.
Definitely. I share all my information with my husband, but I never take part in the decisions.
I see.
And sometimes he does take decisions that I'm not very pleased with, so it's not that I am like somebody breathing down his neck. I just tell him about my day and about what people tell me, and you know, sometimes he picks up on something. But the situation of the I had told him about the IDPs maybe 7 or 8 years ago, and eventually he did go and visit, and he saw for himself. So he saw that it is a situation that's really untenable.
And what kind of support does he have within his government to do something?
I don't know. I really don't know. I suppose if ever he says let's do it, they will try and do it. I have no idea. But my husband is not the kind that will say, okay, just give an order and wanting people to do it. He will think through the systems, and he's already reinforcing an agency that's called the Land Authority, so that land can be found, because land problems, like in any other post-conflict country, titles to the land are not very clear. It's a big mess. Oh. Some people have forged titles. Some government, because we've had successive government during the Civil War, some government superseded other titles. You know, it's some people have taken over government lands. It's really a big mess. And what he's doing is that he's kind of putting all the authority under this one agency, and maybe that will help.
Rula Ghani, First Lady of Afghanistan. Short break here. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from CA Technologies, who believes that every business is in the software business. CA Software and Services work to help companies optimize their digital transformation in the application economy. More information is at ca.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems, at pewtrusts.org. And from the estate of Miles Gatterman, whose bequest is in appreciation of public radio and its commitment to introducing music to all walks of life.
David Troyer's new novel, Prudence, is set in the 1940s on a Native American reservation in Minnesota, where the government's built a camp for German prisoners of war.
It always struck me as so ironic that during the war, all these Germans showed up and all the Indian men were gone fighting.
On the next Fresh Air, Troyer talks about the book, his family, and his own life on the reservation. Join us.
Have many emails and phone calls for our guest today, Rula Ghani, First Lady of Afghanistan. And I want to remind you, you can watch video streaming of the show. You can go now to drshow.org and watch live. Our first email, Mrs. Ghani, what is your position on honor killing of women and girls?
I'm definitely against it. I don't think there's anything either in the religion, whichever religion it is, whether Christian or Muslim, or in the tradition that justifies it. Honor killing, unfortunately, is very common in all of the Middle East. No, I don't think it's dehumanizing the woman and her feelings.
Why does it happen throughout the Middle East, and specifically in Afghanistan?
I think Afghanistan is not different from the other countries in the Middle East in that regard. I think there has been an evolution of a decidedly patriarchal society where men consider that the honor of their family is linked to the honor of their wives, daughters, And but I think it becomes a knee-jerk reaction. They don't really they don't really try to understand the situation, and they make it their own problem when it's not their problem.
What kind of situation in Afghanistan would bring about the honor killing of a woman or a young girl?
Well, because indeed it's very easy to start rumors about a young girl or a woman, to say, oh, I've seen her walking on the street with so and so, or she was in the fields and she was talking to that person. And suddenly, from one little rumor, a whole story comes out, and it's all fictitious. And in many cases, honor killings kill innocent people who have not done anything. Now, sometimes it is a question where there is an elopement, a person who tries to elope with somebody that is not recognized as a suitable husband for her. And sometimes they manage, sometimes they don't, and then it gets to be honor killing because. But what I really resent is the fact that often it is on hearsay. It's usually a dispute between two families, and one family wanting to hurt the other family will start talking about their women, and then the other will just take the bait and say, oh, but, you know, our honor. It's totally ridiculous. It has no sense at all.
It must be horrific for you as First Lady when you hear about such an honor killing.
It is. I must say, these stories don't come to me. Up till now, I haven't heard of any honor killing during my tenure, my very short tenure as a First Lady. So I don't know also what is the role of the media in that, and whether looking for sensational whenever there is an honor killing, they kind of exaggerate it. There are other stories also of, harassment, of sexual harassment, that also cause honor killing. And instead of killing the woman, what they should do is educate the man, respect the woman. I don't know. It's a very difficult topic.
Indeed. All right. Let's open the phones. 800-433-8850. First to Stephen in Birmingham, Michigan. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning, Mrs. Ghani.
Hello.
Good morning.
My question for the First Lady is, does your agenda include efforts to safeguard the right for Afghan girls and women to receive education? And if so, how effective do you think you can be in those efforts?
I definitely believe in education. Education for everyone, whether women or girls, boys or men. I think with education, your world widens. You understand the relativity of things, and you're more able to make clear decisions. So, yes, I am definitely going to try and help. But I don't have agendas. I just kind of, receive the concerns of people. Like now I hear your concern about education. And if I find myself in a different setting with people talking about education, I convey that concern.
All right, let's go to Jennifer in Nassau, Florida. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning, First Lady.
Hello.
Good morning.
It's an absolute honor to speak with you. I think that what you're doing, being such a vocal voice of a First Lady of Afghanistan is an amazing thing.
Thank you.
Do you receive much backlash from your own country? Maybe citizens who feel that as a woman, regardless of your standing as First Lady or not, that it's your job to remain quiet and cloistered within the palace, not becoming such a vocal and interested and engaged person in the hierarchy of your country?
As I said earlier, I am not that that much of a vocal person, or I don't create that much waves in Afghanistan. Everybody, all the women know that they can come and talk to me. And I try to help them, but I don't want to upset the apple cart.
But you are here in the United States speaking out, and surely your fellow countrymen and women know that that is expanding your visibility, if not your willingness to speak out.
Well, I've never had a problem with visibility. I've given interviews in Afghanistan. But I am not a political actor over there. I am a voice. Yes, I speak up. Yes, I say, but I don't have any weight. I'm just a First Lady. So maybe here, because the medias are so prolific, and maybe because so many people have been wanting to talk to me, I'm getting my 15 minutes of fame. But I'm going to go back to my office, which is in a small little house, and I will carry on meeting people and seeing people and trying to help. In all my intervention, I always try to be positive. I never present a problem without trying to find its solution. I think that's the way to go, because you can complain forever, but if you don't present any solution, you're not helping the situation.
Here's an email from Laura in Hershey, Pennsylvania, who says, what would Mrs. Ghani like people, and specifically children, to understand about the people of Afghanistan? What does she feel are similarities and differences in the cultures, the daily lives of people, and the dreams of people?
People all over the world have the same dream, to have a better life. That's for sure. In Afghanistan, the people are just wonderful. They're very open. They're really, if you treat them as equals, they treat you so well. I've always had very good interaction with everybody that I have worked with or lived with or interacted with in Afghanistan. They are proud people. They're not beggars. Despite all the international aid that has been poured in Afghanistan, they don't go around with their begging bowl. They try to do a life for themselves. And so I want people to understand that they are hardworking people. The women especially are facing a lot of problems because of some misbegotten tradition, but they are trying to do the best they can with the little they have. I was being interviewed by a journalist a few days ago, and after the interview, we asked her to join us for lunch. And so there were three other Afghans, young ones, and she had the ability of asking them what their life had been. And she saw for herself how they had to face the various stages of the civil war, the Soviet occupation, then the Mujahideens, then the Taliban, how this disrupted their studies, how they had to... One lady was saying she had to leave Kabul, and she was in her second year of university, it was only 10 years later that she had to join back the university and was able to finish her diploma. In the meantime, she had gone back to her village. She tried to start a school in the mosque in her village, and for that purpose wore the niqab and everything to be able to bring the children and teach them things in the mosque. Then when she became too serious about her school, they asked her to get out of the mosque, and she built a school in her village. And now she very proudly can say, she's now maybe in her late 30s, that some of her students are now in university. And she is here, she's working in Washington, D.C., and she is enrolled in an MA program. She wants to get an MA program, and she's very keen that her 14-year-old daughter gets the best education she can have. So that shows you that this woman, who really comes from a modest background and had used some opportunities but found them totally disrupted, kept on going, kept on trying, kept on finding ways of building a school, of continuing her education. Afghan people are like that. They're very resilient. They are very self-motivated. And this is why I think we are in for a good future.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. There is some concern about U.S. troops departing too quickly from Afghanistan, and now perhaps a slowdown in that regard. Would you, as an individual and as a woman and as First Lady, feel more confident if U.S. troops were to stay longer to safeguard the peace that has been attained in Afghanistan?
If the U.S. troops leave, that means that the Afghan security forces have to take over. So basically what you're saying, what you're asking is, are the Afghan security forces ready to take over? I'm not quite sure. I'm not a specialist in that area, but I know that they have improved a lot in the past few years. And I know that it is one of my husband's, the president's, concerns to establish security in Afghanistan. So I don't know how to answer your initial question. U.S. troops have helped a lot, have helped bring stability, but now we need security. And maybe that only can be done through Afghan forces, and maybe what the U.S. troops should be now in a role of mentoring more than in a role of fighting, you know, making sure that the Afghan forces know how to do it.
Do you think that there are enough of those Afghan forces who do understand how to take on that role and to do it well? Enough to protect your country?
I think we're getting there. I think we're getting there.
One last question I wanted to ask you. Do you wear the hijab in Afghanistan?
Yes.
You do?
Oh, yes. No, I mean, I'm cognizant of the traditions of the country. And in Afghanistan, I'm always wearing a scarf. I don't know if you'd call it a hijab, but it's a scarf that I wear, and I am covered. And I always dress modestly, whether here or there.
Thank you.
No, but I think the reason I'm not always wearing it here is because I've lived here for 30 years, and I find it very hypocritical to suddenly start wearing a scarf here, because I know... You know, I've always been going around without a scarf here, so why should I wear it here?
Are you ever criticized back at home for how you appear here in this country?
I don't know. This is my first trip. I'll find out.
You'll find out. Well, it's been a true pleasure.
Thank you,
Diane. To talk with you. Thank you so much for being here.
It was my pleasure, too.
And good luck.
Thank you.
In all your efforts.
Thank you.
Rula Ghani, First Lady of Afghanistan, her husband Ashraf Ghani was inaugurated President of Afghanistan last September. And thank you all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.